that's really what they were.
Paul made that very clear. So did Jesus. Jesus said, whoever divorces their spouse causes them to commit adultery. Whoever marries the one so divorced commits adultery. What about that, don't you understand? The Apostle Paul said a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if he be dead, then and then only is she free to remarry, but then only to a true follower of Christ. What about that, don't you understand? It's not difficult, friends. It is not difficult. What is making this difficult is the fact that there is like a snowballing effect. It's just another way of describing this situation. The snowballing effect of unrighteousness that has swept through the land for the last 50 years. And now, the unrighteousness of a divorce and remarriage when our spouses are still living has been used to undergird the snowballing effect of spreading of homosexuality, not only in this country, but all over the world. And we'll be held to account for this. So again, I ask you, are you approving of those that do this? If so, from the position of the Apostle Paul in Romans 1, you are as guilty as they. Now you can see why, day after day, we talk about preparing the way of the Lord. If the last days are going to see the spirit of Elijah call forth the heart of the fathers to the children, heart of the children to the fathers, there's going to have to be a rectification of this sexual confusion, isn't there? Will it start with you? The scripture says, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So much more I could say. My heart is broken because I know how many toes have been stepped on today. But God will heal you. He'll forgive you if you'll confess your sin. He's faithful and just. Forgive your sin and cleanse you from all unrighteousness. Do it today. Don't delay. Jesus is coming soon.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, it may very well be they're going to be your views as well, because our regularly scheduled guest has not called in. Now, our regularly scheduled guest has been with the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, for 30 years. He's retired. I came to know him, three or four years ago. We've had him on the program a number of times since then. He is still in contact with people in the intelligence service. He told me on Monday, I called him, and told me he is going to be moving to Europe and will be there indefinitely, at least for a good long while. Now, one reason, of course, I called him was because I'd heard from several sources that intelligence agents are moving out of this country. They've been told, people retired from the intelligence services, that we're going into a very difficult time in this country and that they should leave this country. Now, I've gotten this from one individual that I know very well, he was with the intelligence agencies, and he has simply sold his house and he's moving out of the country. I heard another interview this last week with a fellow named Graham Greene, who claims he was affiliated with intelligence, at least knows a great deal about it. And he said that a number of intelligence agents have been told to leave the country because we're going into a period of chaos and crisis. Well, we're just going to have to wait and see what's going on. But hopefully we have John with us now. Calling from the, good evening, John. How are you tonight?
Good evening. Good to hear from you.
Well, it's good to hear from you. I was a little worried that you wouldn't be with us. Anyway, would you like to sort of bring us up to date with what's happening over there in the Middle East?
Yeah, well, we're very, very close to military action. The best kind of indicator now is that almost everybody believes that they are ready for some type of military action that's going to take place in the next couple weeks between Israel and Iran. The United States has made a commitment to Israel. A number of different things have happened. If you go down the different countries, one of the key players has been Syria, who has been arming Hezbollah with lots of Scud missiles in secret bases. There's also the indication, which I think is quite exaggerated, that the Iranians now have long-range missiles. They don't have that many of them, but it seems like almost a pretext that the Pentagon has said they're using this as an excuse to back up Israel. The other indicator is that Mr. Obama has put in tough sanctions. The Iranians are very worried. So I would say that everybody is basically ready for war. They believe that Iran believes they have enough smaller missiles. Hezbollah believes they have enough missiles. Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and some of the other Emirates have been supplied with Patriot missiles by the United States. They are now all deployed. And Israel is just basically feels that if they don't strike now, things are going to get worse in the next 6 months to a year.
And, of course, I'm sure Israel is very, very concerned about the missiles that Hezbollah has and that Syria has. In fact, everything I'm hearing is that they anticipate if the attack comes, there will be biological and chemical warfare agents. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I don't know. There's lots of different rumors going around. Trying to separate a lot of the fact from the rumors with good intelligence is very difficult.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, John, you go right ahead. The trouble is, you know, we sit here, you know, back in the States, we really have very little idea what's going on. I don't think most Americans even realize that we have an armada of probably close to 100 ships over there in the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea. This certainly would look to me like a prelude to war. You don't bring in an armada like that and you can't keep it there indefinitely. You're going to have to do something or disband it.
That's right, and going back to Syria just for a moment, the Syrians have supplied Hezbollah through secret bases to Lebanon these new M-600 missiles, and you mentioned biological warfare. These missiles are capable of carrying something like a half-ton warhead with very, very specific accuracy. And they can hit a target within like 20 to 30 yards. So Hezbollah feels empowered. And what the Iranians like is that they're their puppet, and they're taking care of their flank, so to speak. Okay, so Hezbollah, you know, last time when they fought Israel, they only had about 4,000 or 5,000 Katyusha rockets. And the war lasted 34 days. They think with these rockets they can really damage Israel tremendously. And, of course, they're allied to Iran. So that's what their plan is. The other plan that the Iranians have, they've changed their military plan several times, is that they will let Hezbollah attack Israel. They may not retaliate if Israel hits them. but they may do something to block the oil in the Gulf, which would damage our economy and Japan's economy and so on. And one of those indicators is that over the last few months, the Chinese have really topped off their fuel tanks from Iran and other countries. The Chinese feel very, very strong that their manufacturing and economy will continue because they are basically awash with oil. And when you're talking about economic warfare, the Iranians, who are in real bad shape and are very angry at the new sanctions that the Obama administration has put in, believe that what they have to do is damage the United States economy, and that would be blocking all of the shipping coming out of the Gulf.
Well, Sidney, you know, if oil were to go up to $150 or $200 a barrel, this would certainly raise the price of gasoline to $5, $6 a barrel, and this would have a profound impact on trucking, on aircraft, on everything in America. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is John Quirk, and John is apparently... are you in the States, or have you gone overseas?
No, I'm in Azerbaijan.
All right, in Azerbaijan. So we were expecting you were going to be in Florida, but I guess you're over there, so you're pretty close to where all these things are taking place. Well, now, Chris, one of the things is that, you know, certainly Israel was going to have a terrible time, you know, fending off, you know, the 50 to 100,000 missiles they have between Hezbollah and Syria. What about the anti-aircraft? Do we know anything at all about the Israeli missile defense? We've heard rumors that they have a secret missile defense, a laser system called the Nautilus, which may very well help them be able to ward this off, because logically there's no way they could survive a missile attack. There's got to be something they've got up their sleeve that the average individual, both in Israel and the United States, doesn't know about. Have you heard any rumors along that line?
Yes, they have a new missile defense plus Patriot missiles long-term supplied by the United States. The problem is the issue of, that you said, biological warfare. The Israelis have all been issued gas masks for their animals, for their children, and so on and so forth. But the problem is, in addition to Hezbollah with these Syrian rockets, the Iranians now have something like 15 different types of rockets. They had these liquid fuel rockets called the Shabads. Now they have Shabad 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. They have these Mushkak rockets, which are solid propellants and so on. And they probably have several thousand of these that are very, very accurate. They can go anywhere from 800 kilometers to 5,500 kilometers. They have expanded the Shabad 3 stage, it's called the Shabad 5 and 6, because they can go 3,000 to 5,500 kilometers. So they're ready, the Syrians are ready, and Hezbollah is ready. The kind of odd man out in this whole thing has been the United States, because Obama pulled all of our forces out, now he's moving them back in. He delayed Patriot missiles going into Saudi Arabia, and now they're completely deployed. So he's probably, and his administration is very much on board. The Pentagon is extremely pro-Israel and wants to do everything possible. Recent statements by Admiral Mullen, head of the Joint Chiefs, Petraeus, and McInerney have indicated that the United States is ready to back up Israel in every facet of a military attack against Iran. So it's, like you said, a prelude to war, and it's almost, as I've mentioned before, like Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August. Everybody's waiting for something to happen, some kind of provocation that would indicate and justify all of their actions to start war.
Well, I don't think most Americans understand that when you put sanction on a country, that is an act of war. When we've been financing terrorist groups over there for a number of years, we gave $400 million to CIA to finance terrorist groups to overthrow the government. That's an act of war. The average American doesn't want to go to war with Iran, and yet it would appear that we're going to war whether the American people want it or not, and all there'd have to be would be some action on the part of the Iranians to have a few Americans killed, and would plunge into this war, and we could lose thousands or tens of thousands or heaven knows how many. This is what's so frightening, because when you start a war, you never know how that war is going to end. And our the naval armada over there and our troops there in Afghanistan and Iraq, and my personal feeling of that is why we haven't pulled them out. But what do you think is going to happen? Saudi Arabia apparently has given Israel rights to fly over their property, and they're planning their attack on Iran. In fact, we've even heard that there have been some Israeli fighter planes actually landed at a Saudi air base. I would think that probably Iran would retaliate against Saudi Arabia. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, what Washington has done is a full-court press to help Saudi Arabia. We have a special forces group, not just a small group, but a large special forces military group in Saudi Arabia that's specifically developed to protect the oil installations. And then in addition to the Patriot missiles, they've gone to Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Kuwait. It said that, and the other thing is the United States has moved special ships which offer a missile shield to protect our allies there in the area if Tehran retaliates. So the best way to look upon this type of war, you know, America is a very technological, scientific, computer-oriented kind of country that runs wars, but the best way to look upon it is, going back to my old social studies days, is taking an interdisciplinary approach. You have to look at it politically, economically, militarily, even culturally. Politically, a war like this would probably help Obama's popularity. It would detract from a lot of criticisms regarding our efforts in Afghanistan. Most of the American public is against Afghanistan. The military is dragging its feet on troop withdrawals in Iraq. They're worried about Iran. That's the politics of it. Also, the politics of it internationally is that the United States wants to show its Arab allies that we have a divisive relationship with a Muslim country that is not Arab, Iran. Politically, we want to go out of our way also to support Israel. Politically, it will help the European Union. Economically is what I'm worried about. Even a brief war could cost billions of dollars for the United States. We would have to resupply Israel. That's more billions. And it would be, I think, an economic disaster, even if we were able to keep the Gulf open. I don't think it would be a short war like people predict. I think it could be an expanded war, and expanded wars would drain our economy.
This is a concern to me as well, and certainly the question is, would there be perhaps some terrorist attacks, really effective terrorist attacks here in the United States? And we hear rumors about that there really are terrorist training camps in this country. There really are people who so far have not done anything at all, but the fear would be that certainly if we really got into a serious war over there, that these people might attack America's homeland. Is there any truth to these stories about terrorist training camps here in America?
You know, they've had various people go into the mountains and train, but the FBI, which is responsible for national security counterintelligence and national security counterintelligence against operatives in Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda, we do have Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda operatives in the United States. The Bureau knows a lot about them. I think that if there were hostilities, they would be monitored and arrested right away, just like the FBI did it to the German spies in World War II, and we did it to the Russians a few weeks ago. So the Bureau knows what's going on. They've developed fantastic networks of informants in the Muslim communities who are working with us, so I don't think that's so much of a threat. I think a bigger threat would be overseas at American embassies and facilities. And those would be in Yemen, Somalia, Chad, and so on. One of the things that the Bush administration did, he never gets any credit for it, and Obama has continued it, we have very good relationships with most of the Arab intelligence services except for Pakistan. Pakistan doubles against us. They're duplicitous, and we're trying to control that and outmaneuver them. But the rest of the services, Morocco, Tunisia, even Libya, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, have worked very hard with the United States to identify all the bad actors. And I think we're in pretty good shape there. I don't think we would have any terrorism in the United States, but there would be some against our facilities overseas. There might be attacks on diplomats, our embassies, or some of our military bases.
Well, one of the things that really concerns me is we have a large contingent of forces there in the Green Zone in Baghdad, and certainly we have our large contingent camps there in Afghanistan. My concern is that these would be sitting ducks if the Iranians decided to retaliate. Now, do you think that probably Iran will not retaliate if it's attacked because they do not want to give the Americans a justification for coming into the war? Could that possibly happen?
That's a very good question, but going back to the interdisciplinary approach politically, let's look what Iran would do. If Iran is attacked, they would hope that would unify the country, because something like 60 to 70%, especially the young people in Iran, are fed up with the current regime. So an attack on Iran, the administration in Iran would hope that it would develop patriotism against the average Iranian. They would use a lot of propaganda that America and Israel trying to destroy Islam and so on. So that in itself would help the regime. An attack against Iran would help the regime. Now, there are a lot of rumors lately that the Iranians will not retaliate. 6 months ago, the Iranian battle plan was to even do feints or send troops into Iraq, attack the Saudi oil fields and Kuwaiti oil fields to damage us economically. A lot of those theories have gone kind of quiet now, and everything seems to focus on what Hezbollah and Israel are going to do. It's very difficult to say. A lot of our good intelligence comes out of Azerbaijan, comes out of technical intelligence from the National Security Agency, some from the CIA, and then from defectors that we have recruited lately from, Iran and other people that know what the nuclear situation is. It seems that in democracies we have to have unbelievable proof of what the Iranians are doing, so we don't get into a situation like we had in the Bush administration about are there weapons of mass destruction or not in Iraq, and what's that prelude to war? In this particular case...
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment here with Sean Quirk. Go right ahead, John.
Yeah, it's interesting because, the Middle East envoy on behalf of, the United Nations, the EU, NATO, Russia...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for are people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called immune support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Has no idea what's going on because our attention is being focused on, oh my goodness, football is going to start this weekend, the first game there between the Dallas Cowboys and the Bengals. Ladies and gentlemen, that is of no consequence at all. What's really important is what's going on over there in the Near East and the Middle East, and totally or almost totally blocked out by the controlled media in my estimation. But I was just asking, certainly John is saying that there's concern, certainly, that the Iranian missiles, very sophisticated missiles, might be able to hit our carriers, and so we're going to keep the carriers back away, certainly not centralize them there in the Persian Gulf, but pull them back as far as we conveniently can and still be effective. But what about this idea that Iran has a lot of very small boats and are, I don't know, torpedoes or whatever they would be, or maybe suicide boats? Would they actually be a danger to our carriers if you had 1,000, and that's what they've said, we've got 1,000 small boats for every one of their carriers. What are your thoughts, what do military people think?
Yeah, they have something called Hoot torpedo, and they have. Here's what their armaments are. They have Russian anti-aircraft batteries that can shoot down an Israeli plane something like 50 to 90 miles away. They have a lot of those supplied by Russia. They have this new Hoot torpedo, which is a supplement to their missile program. And it's pretty accurate. It's not, you know, you can't denigrate them. They have a lot of range. They have Iranian ballistic missiles that can hit Azerbaijan where I am. They could hit Armenia, Georgia, Turkmenistan, and they could certainly hit Bahrain, Saudi Arabia. They really would be fairly inaccurate. They don't have that many if they try to hit Israel, okay? So they would try to defend, you know, as much as they possibly can. They do have a pretty good punch in the area of missiles. They've got something like
300 to 500 of these Shibad ballistic missiles, which can hit the Gulf states. But the overall military capabilities do not compare with what Israel could do to them, the United States, or even some of their neighbors. Now, there is a plan, a theory, that all of this pressure might bring Iran back to the negotiating table. If Russia doesn't support them, if they've got all the other Arab countries against them, they know Israel's nobody to toy with. They know that Obama has really supported Israel recently. So they might
just surprise everybody, and then, you know, you go for the carrot and stick again. The stick is these sanctions and threats of military action. The carrot is what we've offered them in the beginning, to release their money, drop some of the sanctions, and so on and so forth. So the Iranians are very smart people. The problem is their fanaticism is almost like the militarists in Japan. They just don't want to give in. They want nuclear weapons. And so there's still a chance, you know, there's still a chance of diplomacy. The Russians are pushing for that. The United States is in the background supporting it. But I think the clock is ticking for Israel. Israel is the one that's going to be calling the shots now.
In other words, America is going to be drawn into this, and basically we will not make the decision. Israel will make the decision, but of course we're going to have to pay with our blood for whatever they decide to do.
Yeah, but the future would probably be worse, because if you give Iran the capability to deliver nuclear warheads, okay, beyond Iran, their main target would be Israel. So Israel is focused on their whole national security policy regarding Iran's intransigence on not having any kind of negotiation at this very stage to give up their nuclear program. The other thing is there's a possibility of chemical and biological warheads, okay? And now, they don't think Iran has those, but you never know, because our intelligence in that area really isn't that good.
Well, how about Syria, though? There's a simply, I think many people believe that Syria got some of the chemical and biological warheads from Saddam Hussein. We'll be back in just a moment here with John Quirk, and he'll answer that question. We'll have to I'll let you know what he says when we get back from the break. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest John Quirk. And John, Sydney, what about the possibility that Syria does have chemical and biological warheads? Sydney, it would appear that the Israelis believe that they do. Otherwise, they would not have really been as aggressive in getting those gas masks out in the last 2 months. Why, they've been going from door to door. They've been actually fitting the gas masks to children and to animals, and they've been really a very aggressive program to make sure that everybody in Israel has a gas mask, so they must be anticipating some sort of chemical or biological attack, don't you think?
Yeah, the Israelis, if you talk to average Israelis or military or former current intelligence officers, they all say it's imminent, very imminent, that the Netanyahu government is going to attack Iran. You see, Iran's overall policy, they think that they will have a strategic advantage and some kind of logic that if they have a small bomb or two or three bombs, that will back everybody off. And that's what they're going for. They're not going to stop developing their nuclear warheads. They think that it's going to give them, their national security, a big advantage in the area. And they have a lot of reasons, which I don't think are very valid, but they think then the other Arab states will back off. They'll be the regional power in the area. They're a good ally of Russia. It'll actually strengthen the relationship between Russia
and Iran in the region and be a foil to the United States' efforts to pump more oil out of Central Asia, which is Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, where Russia and China are vying for that oil, and so on and so forth. But I think things have changed quite a bit. I think that Israel and the United States now, with the sanctions, the EU, the support of a lot of Arab countries, are in a much better position. Which one of the things that tells me that Israel is going to attack is not so much the intelligence estimates of how far Iran has developed nuclear weapons, but one of the things it tells me is the support Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Republics, Armenia, Azerbaijan, believe in the United States. They are all on board. They're very, very positive. They're not worried. It's like they've all agreed, like they all got together in some kind of secret meeting, and they've all said, and I'm talking about
Saudi
Arabia.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess John Quirk, and John is saying that it's almost as if everybody's in agreement that the Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates and all of these countries have agreed, you know, that they're going to back Israel. In fact, they want Israel to take out Iran because, of course, they're Shia Muslims. They're Sunni Muslims, and Iran is Shia Muslims, and there's just a terrible animosity between these two branches of the Muslim faith. So, apparently, they fear very much the Shia regime, and they want Israel to do this. My understanding is that there actually have been sightings of Israeli fighter planes at Saudi bases. Have you heard anything at all about that?
I've heard that they've landed to coordinate if there are air attacks. I know that Israel has trained extensively with NATO on bombing runs. And the other thing, just getting back for a minute, another social science approach, is that if there's a war, Hezbollah and Hamas could be wiped out. And that would lay the groundwork for peace with Fatah. The other thing is, Syria, they're interdisciplinary. Syria's economy is doing very well. They would suffer extremely heavy casualties. I would say that Syria has made a lot of very stupid mistakes in setting up secret bases for Hezbollah. But see, they're pressured by Iran. Iran is behind Syria's helping Hezbollah. Iran gives money to Hamas. And Iran gives lots of money to Hezbollah. So if you remove, you can do one of two things. You can remove Iran from the chessboard in terms of attacking them, maybe even wiping out the leadership and stopping their nuclear plan, and at the same time eliminating support for Hezbollah and Hamas. Now, the other way, if it doesn't start with attacking Iran, if Hezbollah starts something, Hezbollah and Hamas, and this is from Israeli military people, they tell me, they'll be wiped out in a couple days. So if Hezbollah and Hamas are wiped out, that leads the way for some kind of better relations and political settlement in the Middle East with the Mitchell plan. And at the same time, it eliminates any kind of support for Iranian funding of Hezbollah and Hamas. So there's a lot at risk here for Hezbollah and Hamas. They could have heavy casualties. The Syrian economy could be ruined. And I think everybody is getting fed up with Iran. They fund Hezbollah with military aid, money, equipment, medical supplies, and, of course, missiles. They fund Hamas, and they spend a lot of propaganda in Europe making out Israel as the bad guys. And they pressure Syria, who wants to come back in kind of the world of nations. Syria would like better relations with the United States. And Europe, and they're being caught up in all this. So these little players that have lots of arms are in jeopardy of being completely wiped out if Iran or Israel starts something.
Well, of course, the thing is that Syria is so very, very close to Israel, and so you can go up to the top of the Golan Heights, and you can look over, and you can see Damascus. And certainly, if Syria comes into the war, I'm sure Israel retaliates just with vicious and just wipe out Damascus. And certainly, I think one of the Israeli leaders had told the Syrian leaders that if you come into the war, why, of course, when the war is over, the existing government, it's a Shia government there, will no longer exist. And, of course, it's a Shia government in Syria, my understanding, is really very much of a minority government. It maintains its power only through a ruthless dictatorship. And, boy, if the war comes with the Sunnis, they'll probably rise up and kill all the Shias. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, that's correct. What I have heard is that the United States is the one that has obtained intelligence on the secret missile basis that Syria has for supplying Hezbollah and transporting them to Lebanon for Hezbollah. What's interesting, the Israelis never talk about it. They refuse to supply any intelligence on it, which tells me that they have it, which means that they've targeted all these bases where they're keeping these caches of missiles in Syria and Lebanon. And my friends in Israel tell me they know every base, every arms storage. They know exactly what they would do to wipe out Hezbollah. So, I think the byproduct for an attack to have Syria involved would be that there would be political chaos in Syria. The Lebanese government, which is very, very afraid of Hezbollah, dominated by Hezbollah, would probably welcome the destruction of Hezbollah, and they want better. Lebanon wants better relations with both the United States and Israel. This whole thing would eliminate a flank problem that Israel has with Hamas and the Gaza Strip. It would eliminate Hezbollah, and the main thing, the main focus, would be to stop Iran's nuclear program. So in the next couple of weeks, Iran is in a position that they can open negotiations. Now, there are some rumors that they have recently, in the last few days, contacted the Clinton people and said, we're ready to sit down and talk about things. And that is, it's not like some kind of North Korean brinkmanship, that the North Koreans use against us and Japan and South Korea. But the Iranians are very smart people. They don't want their culture destroyed. They might make a play to give up part of their nuclear research in terms of getting something, the carrot approach rather than the stick. So I think the next 2 weeks would be crucial. I think if there is not any very strong movement diplomatically by Russia, with the United States, with Iran, Israel will probably launch in the last week of August, which is coming around, or possibly the first week in September.
Well, now, what about the wild card, which is Turkey? Certainly, Turkey traditionally has been very friendly with Israel, but in recent months has been taking on a more pro-Iran direction, and this is really a rather frightening thing, because Turkey certainly does have a very powerful military. What's Turkey going to do? Do you think they'll sit on the sidelines? Do you think they'll side with Iran, or what?
Well, there's a move by the Turkish government, as you know, to, try to please the other Muslim countries in its relationship. But I'm told that relations between Turkey and Israel are back on track. Turkey has just received a lot of other weapons from the United States, that they're friends, always been friends with the United States. And although we had some bumps in the road about the flotilla coming in and our support of Israel, that Turkey is back talking to Israel, and Turkey is supporting any kind of move that the United States would make. Maybe they won't say it openly, but with Al Jazeera or other places, but Turkey does not want to see a strong nuclear Iran. So I think Turkey is not going to be a problem. I would say 3 months ago it was a problem, but I think the United States has done a very good job diplomatically on getting the two countries together again.
I think that is really rather good news, because I would hate to see Turkey there, because they could go one way or the other. If they went with Iran, they would be a real problem, both for America and for Israel. Well, is there any possibility, do you think, that what's happening in any way might end up with a nuclear confrontation? This is what Fidel Castro said about 2 weeks ago, and I realize, of course, Fidel Castro is an old man. He's a couple of years older than I am, but he still seems to have a fair amount of knowledge about what's going on. He was warning about this coming war with Iran, and he was saying that it could very well end up with some sort of a nuclear confrontation. Now, years ago, I can remember back in the early 90s, the fellow who headed the Republican Research Committee, and I've forgotten his name, but he wrote a couple of books. One of them, he said that Iran at that time did have a couple of small atom bombs, not anything large, but they did have a couple of atom bombs. Is there any possibility that Iran really does have a couple of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think it's unlikely, but what bothers me, and it doesn't seem our policymakers take it seriously, is the relationship of Iran to Venezuela. Iran owns a big container port. Iran is mining weapons-grade uranium in Venezuela. There's Iranian intelligence officers in the Heliosite intelligence building. They give aid to FARC. They help. And I would think that what the Iranians would do, if they would not launch a nuclear attack at this stage of their development against Israel. They don't have that accuracy with their missiles, and I don't think they have, if they have any, I don't think they have any, but if they have, intelligence estimates say that they might only have one or two small atom bombs. But I think there's a greater danger that they would slip it into Venezuela, and Venezuela would try to deploy it in the United States. We have a lot of intelligence on Chavez's plans, his speeches, what he's doing, and that to me is a greater fear that we would be blindsided in a nuclear Pearl Harbor by somebody that we've undermined. And I think we constantly undermine Venezuela, and I think this guy is one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I lived in Venezuela. I investigated him. My wife is Venezuelan. I followed Venezuelan intelligence operations since the time Chavez get in his relationship with Cuba. And both Castro and Chavez would love to see somebody put a nuke in the United States. They hate this country so much. And who knows? It could come across the border in Mexico. It could be broken up into parts and put in a container and shipped to Miami. You don't know. But a lot of my friends in the policymaking departments actually laugh at that. I would call it American arrogance. And it was the same thing in Pearl Harbor. We never thought Japan would be able to deploy aircraft carriers and strike Pearl Harbor and wipe out our fleet. It's the same thing with 9/11. We never dreamed that there would be people that would take over airplanes and use them as bombs. So I think we have to really look at what Chavez is doing. And if I were in government, I would approve millions of dollars to overthrow that regime before it gets worse.
And, Chris, this is one of my concerns, is that they have steadfastly refused to guard our southern border. They've steadfastly refused to carry out the congressional dictates to build a fence. They've consistently refused to do what was necessary. And if you want to even totally ignore the illegal immigrants, we are certainly theoretically at war with international terrorism, and certainly one of the major financiers of finances of terrorism has been Iran, and certainly as we begin moving into this real direct confrontation with Iran, I would be very concerned that they've already got their agents in this country. If they're smart, they won't be contacting anybody else, just among themselves. We know the Germans were able to smuggle their agents into America during the Second World War. Fortunately, why we captured them all before they could do any harm, but I would think the Iranians, certainly looking ahead, would have their people here over the real possibility of some major cataclysmic event.
Yeah, that's what people like, you know, the bad actors like Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba would like. They believe one nuclear deployment in the United States would ruin us as a superpower. They see that we have a hard time cleaning up the Gulf, responding to Katrina. And the other thing that the Iranians look at, you know, we always talk about our own foreign policy, which is often dominated by our lust for oil and also the good things of spreading democracy and capitalism around the world. The Iranians look at, and the Cubans especially, and Chavez. I mean, Chavez, there's books written about how Obama apparently admires Chavez, is that these countries like Iran and Cuba, they see a leftist, or certainly a liberal government in Washington. And what I see is happening in the United States is that people in the Obama administration try to pit people against each other. They pit blacks against whites, Mexicans against Anglos, North against South, so on and so forth. And as a result, we're not protecting our borders. If you say anything about stopping illegals coming into the country, you're labeled a racist. If you say anything about supporting the Arizona bill, you're labeled a racist. You see, those type of things, and I'm not talking about whether the bill is good or not in Arizona, but it leaves a vacuum for enemies outside the United States to take advantage of shipping things in across the border. And they're smart. The Venezuelan intelligence service is very smart. The Iranians have a good intelligence service. Cuba's penetrated us for years. I mean, they've penetrated the CIA, the FBI. They know everything that's going on in the State Department for a little country. The Venezuelans and Cubans now work together. So, and we don't have the intelligence assets in Latin America that we used to. And only thing Chavez is looked upon as a buffoon. He's broke diplomatic relations with the Colombians now because he's supporting FARC. So you have a terrorist in Venezuela. I mean, that is a terrorist country ruled by Chavez, who is a terrorist. He supports Iran. He hates America. He supports FARC. He's bought millions and billions of dollars of weapons from Russia. And I think that's our soft underbelly. I think that is a real problem.
And because one of the things that amazes me is that he has, or Venezuela has, their own network of gas stations right here in the United States, and the people who are buying that gas are helping to fund Chavez and his relationships with the Russians and the Cubans and the Iranians. I mean, this is madness.
Yes, and he's just signed long-term deals with China to give. We get 14.8% of our oil from Venezuela. He's going to try to reduce that down to 4%. And the people that are making up the difference are the Chinese. So when I say it's our soft underbelly, economically we're losing that oil. Economically, he's spreading his Bolivarian craziness to Bolivia, Ecuador, Argentina. He's supporting the left-wing presidential campaign in Mexico, which would be a disaster because that would, if the leftists get in Mexico, they will ally themselves with the drug cartels, and we see the violence that's happening all along our border from the drug cartels. The Mexican government is losing control of even some of the political situation in small towns, villages, and cities in Mexico.
And not only that, but these drug cartels are actually threatening the lives of American sheriffs and their families. And there's two sheriffs in Arizona that one has $1 million on his head, the other, I think, $250,000 on his head and his family to kill. I mean, when are we going to stand up and say, we're not going to have you allow you to allow your drug people to threaten the lives of our sheriffs?
Well, we have to stop fragmenting in our own country, where the Republicans, all they do is criticize Obama, and Obama is passing massive liberal legislation, and he's
heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
Quirk, and John was supposed to be in Florida. He's been, for whatever reason, he's been called to the Middle East, and certainly I think he's given you an excellent overview of what's going on. Probably within 2 or 3 weeks, why we'll be at war with Iran. I hope it's short, the war. Certainly I know several friends think this will be a very short, easy war, but John doesn't, and I fear that this has been in planning for 31 years. I don't think they're going to let it be off with just a very, very small, short war. I think that their implications of what's going on are certainly frightening. And for you out there in the listening audience, why we don't know what's going to happen, but I believe there are going to be some terrorist attacks here in the United States, I suggest that you get some cash on hand, that you do not depend upon being able to go to the bank to get money, that you certainly get yourself the best shape you can financially, make sure you have a good supply of food, water, perhaps of water filters if you don't already have one so you can purify water, that you have health food products on hand. If you have medical conditions, go to your doctor and get 2 or 3 prescriptions. Tell him of your concerns, and if he laughs at you, just ask him to give it to you, and you certainly will not abuse it, but you need to have supplies on hand to look after yourself and your family. Then understand the spiritual component to this, because if you don't have a personal relationship with our Lord, if you don't understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle, why, of course, you're not going to be able to hold up with the tension that I think is coming and coming very soon. If you've not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. If you prefer watching DVDs, the story's on DVD, but the book gives you the sources of reference, so you can check check out and see if I'm really telling you the truth. And some of the quotations in there will really help you to understand what's going on and will offer you hope, because this is a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And as people analyze what's going on, you know, from the point of view of the United States and the Arab Emirates and the Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey, nobody ever talks about what about God. And you cannot look at the unfolding of events unless you understand that there is a spiritual battle going on, and God sometimes does bring judgments upon nations. Seeing what's happening as far as our acceptance of homosexuality in America, the pornography that's being taught to our kids in our schools. Ladies and gentlemen, these kids know far more about pornography than they do about poetry, far more about sex than they do about Shakespeare. They're destroying the souls of our children. They know what they're doing. Who's doing it? The great tax exam foundations are behind all of this, and behind them, the Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderbergers, Trilateral Commission, people who have a different worldview and are intent upon the impoverishment of the American people. That's what the whole scam about global warming is all about, is simply to limit our use of fossil fuels, to lower our availability of electricity, to simply transfer the remaining manufacturing to other countries to impoverish our people. And God does bring his judgment upon nations. Maybe that's the only way he ever gets the attention of people. Well, I think we're in for some very difficult times. So please, of course, understand we're involved in a spiritual battle. And if you would like to get Sidney Pastor Billy Crone's excellent TV, it's 10 DVD series on the Final Countdown, it's really very important. And you can get the book that goes with that. You can get the 10 DVDs, part 1, part 2, get them both together. And then, of course, he has a great new DVD set on Fearful Creation. Fearful Creation, you see, they've indoctrinated our children in evolution. The Bible can't be true because, after all, the dinosaurs were here 50 million years ago. Ladies and gentlemen, it's all a lie. Dinosaurs existed along with men, but they're not going to tell you that. They're not going to tell your children because they want to destroy their belief in God. So they'll be totally unprepared for what lies ahead. We see increasing crime. Well, why shouldn't we? When you take God out of our community, why shouldn't we have lawlessness? We'll be right back. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. And I'm going to ask our producer if he will call the number there, the number for our guest for this hour. That's William Grigg. And he has to call on line 6. Please use line 6 to call our guest, please. It's easier that way. And certainly we're going to be talking about current events. Certainly William Grigg is certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen we have within the conservative movement. And I'm looking forward to hearing, of course, his views on the issues of importance today. So we'll have you, William, with us hopefully in just a moment here as we begin analyzing what is happening. America is under attack today. It's not under attack from an outside. It's under attack from within. There are people here who hate America, who hate individual freedom. And until you understand that, it's so difficult to understand what's going on. Did you ever wonder why they took God and prayer out of our schools? Why they took the Bible out of our schools? Well, it was simply because people who are part of a secret society control the Supreme Court from 1941 to 1971. The Masons control the United States Supreme Court in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1 for 30 years, and they were the ones who took God and prayer out of our schools. They knew exactly what they were doing. The purpose, of course, of Masonry is to have America become a secular nation. Now, why doesn't anybody ever tell you that? Well, very simply, because our churches, the education of our ministers has been controlled, and ministers are afraid to speak out against Masonry because they've infiltrated churches all across this country. And if you are a minister and you speak out against Masonry, why, you will lose your church. It's just that simple, ladies and gentlemen. That's the reason the ministers have far more fear of the Masons than they do of God. Well, it's about time that we had people who really fear God, and not only in our churches, but in our government and all across America, because we are losing this country. There's no history of a nation at any time in history where a nation has gone into moral decline and that nation has survived. And America today is a nation in moral decline. And with that as a background, our special guest, William Grigg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine, a now author, a talk show host, certainly a regular blogger here. He has his own radio program on the weekends. He's certainly one of my favorite commentators. William Grigg, thanks very much for being with us, William.
Dr. Stan, thank you so much for having me as a guest again. It's always a blessing and a pleasure.
Well, what are we going to talk about tonight?
I want to talk about a phrase and elaborate on it with which your audience might not be familiar. Then again, you've got a very well-informed audience. I know that this is an expression you're familiar with, and that expression from the Latin is sine qua non. And very loosely translated, what that means is without which, how best to put this, that without which we cannot be, that which is indispensable, sort of an awkward way of translating it. But sine qua non refers to those indispensable, non-negotiable preconditions for living. And somebody once said, I believe it's a line from a movie, that there's no stronger force in the universe than necessity. For people who are Christians, of course, the necessity is to know God's will and do it, because you recognize that He is sovereign, He's your creator, He, of course, seeks your happiness so as to bring glory to His name. Knowing and doing the will of God would represent your sine qua non. Now, for those who have a different orientation, the indispensable conditions might be something vastly different. And what we're seeing right now, as this degenerate oligarchy, whose works and poems you were talking about just a minute ago, Dr. Stan, reveals itself in sort of the full flower of its malevolence, is their sense of what is indispensable, their sense of necessity, and their priorities for arranging the world to serve their own interests. And we're finding out that we're by no means dispensable. We're eminently disposable as far as they're concerned, and they're planning to get rid of a whole lot of us very soon.
And, Chris, that was the subject this afternoon. They really do have a population control agenda. They really do intend to kill off most of the people in the world. And, in fact, they're already in the process of it. That's what the vaccine programs throughout the world are, giving those little children the mercury that will epigenetically destroy their ability to be fertile in generations yet unborn. Go ahead, William.
We're not just talking about that facet of the problem, although that obviously is an utterly depraved, and those of us of a religious bent would call it demonic nature. I'm thinking about such things as one of their most useful weapons in organizing, aggrandizing power, centralizing it at their beck and call, and that would be war. War coupled with perhaps famine. I mean, in recent days we've seen some distressing news with respect to some interesting activity with respect to the commodities markets, the grain markets. There was this engineered shortage a couple of years ago that has gotten some very detailed, albeit tardy, attention in the financial press about the way that the markets were manipulated with respect to commodities a couple of years ago. Just in the last couple of days, Premier Putin of Russia, who's really running that government, announced that he would be restricting exports of wheat from Russia. It's to be remembered that about 35 or 40 years ago, the Nixon administration managed to divert almost the entire wheat crop for a year, I believe it was 1972 or 73, to Soviet Russia as one of the favors that our ruling oligarchy would occasionally do for the benefit of their ruling oligarchy. And as a result, that coupled with the softness of the dollar after Nixon decoupled it from gold, you ended up with a huge price shock going through the commodities markets here in the United States and the retail markets for food. That's something that drove more than a few households into bankruptcy, were these two very important moves that apparently took place at the periphery of our daily experience. Not one person in 100,000 understood the significance of what happened in April 1971 when Nixon severed the last few remaining bonds between the dollar and gold. And probably even fewer people understood the implications of diverting pretty much the entire wheat crop to the Soviet Union. But those two developments, of course, had an immediate tangible effect at the dinner tables of every American, particularly those in the middle class. Well, we're dealing now with the same circumstances in a certain way. We've become a net importer of wheat. That's something I learned a few years ago when I was researching an article for the American Conservative magazine. I was astonished by that. How on earth could the United States end up as a net importer of wheat when we, of course, have been the breadbasket to the world? Well, this is something that has been part of the system-wide deindustrialization and offshoring of American industry, including agriculture. And it had gotten to the point where we were importing wheat from Canada and a number of other countries. We're not quite as dependent now as consumers in Soviet Russia were in the 1970s, but the fact that Russia's not going to be putting that wheat on the market is going to have a demand-side impact on our grocery bills. But the biggest impact, of course, is going
to... Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply saying that certainly over in Russia they're having a drought, and so basically there's going to be a shortage of wheat in Russia, and Premier Putin has announced that Russia will not export wheat this year. They will keep the wheat there for their own people. But certainly William is pointing out that we may very well be seeing a shortage of wheat throughout the world, and certainly we know here in California we're one of the great rice producers of the world, but that was a couple of years ago. We have to protect that 3-inch smelt, so we cut off the water. So we're not growing wheat in the Central Valley of California because we have to protect the 3-inch smelt, and so the water is flowing out to the ocean and, of course, diluting the saline there in the bay. But, of course, we now have, at some places in the Central Valley of California, 20, 30, even up to 40% unemployment, thanks to Arnold Schwarzenegger, who refuses to take a stand against his good friend Barack Obama, and they're all in this together, and we're going to see food shortages, I think, here in America in the not-too-distant future. But you go ahead, William.
Yeah, that's one of the main factors that you're talking about here would be the perfect insanity of these eco-socialist controls where, on the basis of this biocentric worldview, that human beings really have no ascendancy in nature above smelt or other non-human species, you're seeing that type of an economic impact that is creating really the conditions for, in a metaphorical sense, a modern dust bowl. You can see the Oki migration in reverse. You can see people pulling up stakes from California. Of course, people are pulling up stakes from California and heading east rather than heading west from Oklahoma and Missouri. I know a lot of people are making sort of a reverse circuit from California and some of these other affected western states to places like Missouri now because of some of the trends you're describing. But this combination now of a potential world shortage of wheat, of course being perhaps the universal mainstay of the human diet, coupled with the likelihood in the very near future of a hyperinflationary shock as foreigners stop buying U.S. debt and the debt has to become monetized, that creates conditions for hyperinflation, and hyperinflation feeding into this would create conditions for shortages and, of course, people seeing their savings, their earnings completely wiped out, not having money to buy what food is available. And this is a scenario that very well could play out the next couple of years, if not sooner. I would say that within the next two to three years, perhaps, we're going to be seeing at least some element of this taking shape. And so the ruling oligarchy right now, while you're seeing on the part of the Clinton administration this dynastic marriage involving the former first daughter to a Goldman Sachs hedge fund manager at the cost of about $4 million and having the FAA shut down the airspace over the wedding site and pretty much a steady procession of the gilded and glittering elite of show business and politics, and then you have the first family, the first lady and her daughters, taking a tour of the Iberian Peninsula and generating a carbon footprint roughly the size of that of Belgium. Now, that's how the oligarchy is tending to its own desires. I mean, these aren't even really needs. These are velleities. These are faint wishes or impulsive, whimsical ideas that they have the means to indulge, where, of course, right now we have 22% or higher unemployment nationwide. And in some parts of the country, you mentioned, of course, what's going on in Central Valley, California, you have unemployment the likes of which have probably never been seen in human memory. And this, I think, is a really good way of demonstrating the stratification that's taking place with respect to our necessity versus their necessity. The oligarchy, of course, is sitting on top of a degenerate democracy with socialist characteristics. It's a corporate democracy, which means that they take from us and they give to politically connected, powerful, and super wealthy people. And in every single socialist system, no exceptions exist. You end up with a more deeply entrenched oligarchy. You end up with a stronger and more rigid stratification in the class structure. You end up with a tiny, entrenched few who do extremely well, and the striving many who are doing very poorly, and some at the bottom are doing so poorly that they really have no means of subsistence. That's our future in this country within the very near term. Not within the next couple of years, necessarily. We're going to see deprivation and privation of that magnitude. But within the next 4 or 5 years, 5 or 6 years, before the end of this decade, we're going to see the United States assuming the characteristics of post-Soviet Russia or some of the Stygian dystopias of Latin America. That's something that was projected a year ago, a little more than a year ago, in an essay from the Atlantic magazine written by a former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. Now, you and I know, and Dr. Stan, I would assume that your audience knows as well, that the IMF are not the good guys by any stretch of the imagination. These are people who are the architects of misery. These are the folks who help to embed these oligarchies and to immiserate the people who aspire to have a middle-class life. But when you see somebody from that milieu speaking in terms of the sort that I'm going to describe right now, it's worth paying attention to, because they're smart people. They're not good people, in the sense that man can be made good by doing those things which resonate with God's law, but they're very smart people. And so it's worth paying attention when somebody writes an essay entitled The Quiet Coup, and this individual is the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. In this essay, and it's a very long essay, I don't have time to do it justice, and I don't have any intention of trying. In this essay, he's talking about the fact that the United States resembles, if you simply remove the brand from the name of the country, if you had a blind test where you were just describing the country without naming it, it resembles nothing so much as a failed state from what we, with undue optimism, call the developing world, or what's more commonly called the third world, or perhaps post-Soviet Russia. Each country of the sort he's describing finds itself in deep, perhaps incurable financial distress because of the business being carried out by the embedded ruling oligarchy. He writes, emerging market oligarchs get carried away. They waste money and build massive business empires on a mountain of debt. Now, of course, once again, let me interpolate into this something that's necessary. We have to talk about this from the context of knowing who the economic hitmen and who the economic hitmen are, these people who peddle debt on behalf of the IMF and the World Bank. Their job is to be debt pushers in the same sense that you'd have narcotics pushers peddling their deadly wares. And in the third world, of course, the economic hitmen, as Mr. Perkins pointed out in his books outlining this nefarious business, they get these emerging market oligarchies hooked on debt to build huge public works projects or private partnerships. And, of course, the same thing goes on here in the United States. It's just that the cast of economic hitmen is a little bit different. Local banks, sometimes pressured by the government, become too willing to extend credit to the elite and to those who depend on them. Overborrowing always ends badly, whether for an individual, a company, or a country. Sooner or later, credit conditions become tighter, and no one will lend you money on anything close to affordable terms. The downward spiral that follows is remarkably steep. Enormous companies teeter on the brink of default, and the local banks that have lent to them collapse. By the way, how many bank defaults have we had this year? We're on a course to have probably half again the number that we had last year. That's part of the syndrome. that this gentleman is describing. Yesterday's public-private partnerships are relabeled crony capitalism. With credit unavailable, economic paralysis ensues and conditions just get worse and worse. Let me interject once again. Public-private partnerships are always crony capitalism. There's no such thing as a public-private partnership that is anything other than corrupt and self-serving. And, of course, the most appropriate synonym for the phrase public-private partnership is fascism. The government is forced to draw down its foreign currency reserves to pay for imports, service debt, and cover private losses. By the way, that's what happened in Iceland. But these reserves will eventually run out. If the country cannot right itself before that happens, it will default on its sovereign debt and become an economic pariah. Let me interject once again. The head of China's bond rating agency, just a couple of weeks ago, commented that the credit rating given to the United States in terms of its sovereign debt by Moody's and some of the other rating agencies is completely nonsensical. It's an artifact of politics. This gentleman, who of course represents the government that has been lending a great deal, if not most, of the money that the government in Washington has been spending, said that if you, once again, removed political considerations from the equation and simply looked at the quality of American debt and the economic performance of the United States, there's no reason on earth why the United States should have a AAA rating. He wants to see that rating to be radically downgraded. And the other point he made that was very provocative, I think, was that the politically dictated credit rating in the United States reflects its perceived military power. But what he pointed out is that that military engine had been built on money borrowed from China. So these people, of course, have perfect awareness of what's going on right now. There's already been some serious rumbling about China dumping a large portion of the debt that it has purchased from the United States. China moving out of the dollar in any significant way is going to cause an avalanche. And that avalanche, of course, to change the metaphor, would be transformed into the reciprocal tide of an economic tsunami as those dollars flood back into the United States. And that, of course, is another way that we end up with hyperinflation. To continue now with this analysis from the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, the government, in its race to stop the bleeding, will typically need to wipe out some of the national champions, now hemorrhaging cash, and usually restructure a banking system that's gone badly out of balance. It will, in other words, need to squeeze at least some of its oligarchs. Squeezing the oligarchs, though, is seldom the strategy of choice among emerging market governments. Quite the contrary. At the outset of the crisis, the oligarchs are usually among the first to get extra help from the government, such as preferential access to foreign currency or maybe a nice tax break, or, here's a classic Kremlin bailout technique, the assumption of private debt obligations by the government. That's exactly what happened in 2008. That's exactly what's going on today. It's going to continue, and things will continue to grow dramatically worse.
Well, I fear that you're absolutely right, and I think the American people, everybody's waiting for things to get better. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not going to get better. Part of it because, of course, we have an impossible financial situation, and partly because we have very powerful people who hate America. Their loyalty is not to this country, but to this internationalist dream. They want a one-world government. They want to destroy Christianity. They're working within our schools. They're working with our universities. They're working within our media. And they intend to impoverish the American people. Go right ahead, William.
Very well.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think it really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Well, then, of course, the Bill of Clinton Foundation has received something like almost $500 million since Bill left the presidency. And that is simply because Bill is such a paragon of virtue and integrity, and people really just like Bill Clinton. All throughout the world, they just keep giving him money and money and money, and he gets, you know, $100,000, $200,000 for giving a talk. But now William is talking about an article that appeared in the recent New York Times. Apparently, it was is that today, William?
Today's, yes.
All right, fine. And it talks about squeezing the little people because, of course, you can't have all this money going to the oligarchy and still have a people, you know, a middle class. And what they intend to do is eliminate the middle class. We'll have a society like they have in Mexico. We have more billionaires than all the rest of Latin America put together in Mexico. And then you have most people living in abject poverty. Those are the people you find in front of the hardware store in your community, in front of Home Depot, in front of Safeway. Way trying to get work. The Mexicans have come up here because there's no hope of advancement in Mexico. We have a two-class society there, and it's coming in the United States. Go right ahead, William.
Exactly. This article begins as follows. Plenty of businesses and governments furloughed workers this year, but Hawaii went further. It furloughed its school children. Public schools across the state closed on 17 Fridays during the past school year to save money, giving students the shortest academic year in the nation and sending working parents scrambling to find care for them. Let me interject here, first of all, that represents 17 Fridays when they weren't being miseducated. But I'm italicizing and underscoring the fact that this is one of those supposedly automatic functions carried out by the government that supposedly, once again, justifies its existence and the expense that imposes on us. Many transit systems have cut service to make ends meet, but Clayton County, Georgia, a suburb of Atlanta, decided to cut all the way and shut down its entire public bus system. Its last buses ran on March 31st, stranding 8,400 daily riders. Even public safety has not been immune to the budget acts. In Colorado Springs, the downturn will be remembered quite literally as a dark age. The city switched off a third of its 24,512 streetlights to save money on electricity, while trimming its police force and auctioning off its police helicopters. Once again, I have to interject. It may not be a bad idea to trim the police force. It certainly would be a good idea to be selling off some of these publicly held assets, but you're talking once again about doing away with streetlights. That's one of those functions that we're supposed to take for granted. That's your tax money at work. Well, all these things that are part of the wallpaper, the civic wallpaper, if you will, of our daily life, all those things we take for granted are being taken from us in order to make sure that there is enough capital around to meet the demands of the politically entrenched oligarchy. Faced with the steepest and longest decline in tax collections on record, state, county, and city governments have resorted to major life-changing cuts in core services like education, transportation, and public safety that not too long ago would have been unthinkable. And services in many areas could get worse before they get better. The length of the downturn means that many places have used up all their budget gimmicks, cut services, raised taxes, spent their stimulus money, and remain in the hole. Very quickly, I have to interject once again, there was a study that was published, or rather a news account of a study published in USA Today about 3 days ago that demonstrated, once again, this is the second or third time I've seen a study about this with respect to the so-called stimulus, that most of the money is being sent to places other than those that are hardest hit by the recession, the depression, the downturn, however you want to characterize it. This money is being allocated on the basis of politics, not on the basis of demand. And what this illustrates, first of all, is the compelling power of politics. It puts up a magnetic field that rearranges all the iron filings in an economy, if you will. And it distorts, of course, by demand, it distorts market demand. And so when you allocate on political terms, you're going to be given to those who have the most influence and not those, of course, who have either the most need or the most to give. And the second thing this illustrates is the fact that the government doesn't believe its own propaganda with respect to the stimulus. If they wanted to use the stimulus to create jobs, they'd be sending the money to where unemployment is the highest. But that's not the way the funds are being allocated. They're being allocated on the basis of political favors and things of that sort. To continue here from the New York Times, even with Congress set to approve extra stimulus aid, some analysts say states are still facing huge shortfalls. Cities and states are notorious for crying wolf around budget time, but the Great Recession has been different around the country. There have already been drastic cuts in core services. And once again, this is all being done because all this stuff is dispensable. But maintaining the exalted lifestyle of the entrenched oligarchy, no, that is non-negotiable. That's their sine qua non, their condition without which life is untenable.
Well, we're going to see some really dramatic changes because, of course, you know, here in California, they have a $500 billion shortfall as far as state pensions. The man primarily responsible was Billy Brown. Somebody said, well, is California going to go bankrupt? And he said, no, they're just going to quit, not going to pay the pensions. Here's the man who did the whole thing, and he's come up with the obvious solution. We just won't pay the pensions. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and you go right ahead, William.
One of the themes that you keep hitting on, Dr. Stan, and I'm glad you do this, is the fact that the elite that commands our government really does not love this country. As a matter of fact, it's not an exaggeration to say that they hate this country. That's not a partisan characterization. It's not a question of whether there's an R or a D or even an I behind the name of a given political figure or what would be the call sign, call letters, or the network identification of a given pundit. If you're talking about people who love power and who seek to aggrandize their own power, they of necessity are going to hate those of us who don't want to be ruled. Every society, without exception, has been ruled by an oligarchy that looks upon the common people as if they were cattle, at the very best. And this brings me to the other element of this discussion about sine qua non, those indispensable conditions for living. I said just a few minutes ago that the people who are running things in this country are doing their level best to ensure that a lot of us get killed in a hurry And that takes us back to the insight of the Carnegie Endowment a century ago when it examined all the multifarious ways that you can acquire power to change a society in a hurry. They did the study, and they determined that war was the most effective and quickest way to bring about system-wide changes, global changes, if you will, in a society. And so the idea was that they needed to get the United States involved in a war in a hurry. This, of course, resulted in World War I, but this, of course, is a time-honored formula going all the way back to Plato, if not earlier, that tyrants have used in order to keep people docile and keep them under control and to acquire and exercise unaccountable power. There was a perfectly scabrous book that came out a few years ago by Philip Roth, who's by no means my favorite writer, a leftist of the old school. And by the old school, I'm talking about a lower Manhattan Marxist school. Then it was called The Plot Against America, and it was a rehash of all the scurrilous, libelous things that had been published against the America First movement way back in the late 30s and early 1940s. And in this novel, Charles Lindbergh was depicted as candidate, dark horse candidate who won the 1940 election and kept the United States out of the war. And it turns out that because there wasn't a war to sublimate all of the murderous impulses of the common people, Americans became predatory fascists. And the idea is that unless you are actively trying to channel people into this government initiative called a foreign war...
Hold that thought, William. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and first of all, William was just talking about, of course, this thing, that war is very useful as a means of controlling the people. War is very useful as far as certainly changing the structure of society. And that is what has happened. That's why we had the First World War and the Second World War and the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the First Gulf War and the Second Gulf War. And why we're going to war in just a few weeks with Iran, ladies and gentlemen, everything is in place. We're going to war, but they're not going to tell you that. It's all planned. And it has nothing to do with defeating Iran. We put the mullahs in power back there back in 1979. We did it intentionally. We helped them. We financed them, and we someday will go into the background of what I personally know, because I had an opportunity to interview William H. Sullivan, who was the American ambassador to Iran at the time of the revolution. But right now, we have our guest, William Grigg. William, would you tell our listeners how they can get to your blog spot, how they can get to listen to your radio program, and how they can find out about your PayPal button and help you as you continue elucidating and bringing out these issues for us? Go ahead.
I really appreciate that, Dr. Stan. My blog is called Pro Libertate. It's ProLiberTate, Pro Libertate. And if you Google that, or if you Google my name, William Grigg or William Norman Grigg, any combination of that, that should be the first of the results that you'll get. If you plug that into Google or any other search engine, you should be able to find that. If not, it's at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. My radio show is also called Pro Libertate. It airs Wednesday nights on the Liberty News Radio Network. That's libertynewsradio.com, libertynewsradio.com. If you go to the website, you'll be able to find the list of local affiliates. There are a number of them scattered across the country. There are some in California. There are others in the Northwest, the Midwest, some in Utah. I believe there are a couple in Idaho, although nowhere near where I live here, unfortunately. libertynewsradio.com, 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time, 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock California Time, is the program on libertynewsradio.com, Pro Libertate Radio. As you mentioned, Dr. Stan, on my blog, at the end of every essay, I do have a PayPal button for those who have the means and the interest in contributing. I really do appreciate it. This is how I'm trying to support my family. I have a family of eight, which is larger than average. I'm sure that there are a number of people of the zero population persuasion who would consider me to be a criminal against the biosphere because my wife and I have six lovely children, but we're unapologetic about that. Each one of them is a unique blessing and utterly incalculable in each one's individual worth. That is my sine qua non. That is the indispensable condition of my existence, is my lovely wife, Corinne, and our lovely children. But the PayPal button is located at the end of every essay, and your listeners have been very generous to me and to my family. That's something for which I am profoundly grateful. And those who have, once again, the means, the interest in donating, please go to the end of every every installment of Pro Libertate, I have data between 2 and 3 times a week, sometimes as often as 4 times a week. And that's a lot of writing because, you know, 2,000 words an essay, that takes up a lot of time and it's just everything else I'm doing. But it's there at the end of every essay, the PayPal button, the Pro Libertate, and that's found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com.
All right, fine. Well, no, basically, because you were talking before I so rudely interrupted you, why don't you pick up that thought?
Sure. I was talking about this alternate history, this novel in sort of a science fiction vein by Philip Roth, not my favorite writer by any stretch of the imagination, called The Plot Against America. And The Plot Against America in this alternate timeline was to have Charles Lindbergh elected with the support of the America First Movement in 1940, and he kept the United States out of the war. And as a result, because we didn't have a war to fight, suddenly the country was overrun with these vile, vicious, despicable middle-class Americans who weren't able to channel their hateful energies into a useful foreign campaign, crusade being directed by the government. And so suddenly the United States became the Reich. And of course, Philip Roth, being a man of depraved imagination, created a scenario in which Lindbergh's child, who of course was kidnapped and presumably murdered, had actually been kidnapped by Bundists and living in Berlin, and this is being used as blackmail leverage against Lindbergh to try to turn the United States into a carbon copy of the Reich. But the thing about this book that I find so useful is this implicit assumption, and actually something that's made explicit at various parts in the book, that unless the United States has a government that is willing to scoop up and to dispose of Americans in large quantities through foreign crusades on behalf of democracy. In the case of World War II, this is pretty much the Holy Crusade to save Joseph Stalin's regime, that these energies, these evil, malignant impulses will reach a critical mass and end up with a perfectly horrible system of government here in the United States. There's one passage in that book that I think illustrates the hatred, this seething, roiling hatred that you refer to, Dr. Stan, on the part of the people who rule us. It describes the typical Kentucky farmer as a crude, vulgar specimen of the Anglo-Saxon Protestants who ran America and would always run it, someone who was able to make a living right out of the earth, eat only food that he himself had raised. In other words, this proverbial yeoman farmer, you know, the person, the specimen of humanity Jefferson said was close to the soil and would be God's chosen person, God's chosen people if God chose a people, from Jefferson's perspective. That is, from Roth's point of view, and from the point of view of the type of people who produced Philip Roth, this intelligentsia, and it's not defined by ethnicity or religion or any other consideration apart from a lust for power, that's the hate object in their worldview. They simply cannot abide the notion that they're independent people in this country that don't need government and want government to leave them alone. And because there are so many people of that sort who've always populated this country, the best thing that can happen from time to time is to have a war. And in writing about this novel a number of years ago, which is really a political manifesto disguised as a novel, I found myself irresistibly led to a quote by the Duke of Sully, who was the chief minister for France under King Henry the IV. The true means of setting the realm at rest is by keeping up a foreign war towards which one can direct, like water in a gutter, all the turbulent humors of the kingdom. In other words, the whole idea here is that you have to have this as a pressure valve, as a way of purging the kingdom, the government, the realm, of all these turbulent and turbid people who otherwise might be taking the management of their own lives into their own hands. Can't have that kind of thing. The thing that I'm haunted by right now, Dr. Stan, is that if you take a look at the history of the United States since, for lack of a more convenient timeline, let's say 1890, there have been 2 minor depressions and 1 major depression in that period of time. In the 1890s, there was this emerging populist movement, as you know, typified by the candidacies eventually of William Jennings Bryan and the related movement for the free coinage of silver. They were rebelling against an oligarchy that has embedded itself with the help of the Republican Party after the war between the states. They were thriving on the tariff, and they were using the tariff basically as a way of taxing people in order to increase corporate profits. That's how the tariff worked in practice. And that's why the tariff, of course, was indispensable, really, to the Republican-created mercantilist economy at the time. In 1897, things had gotten so nasty with the depression that began in the early part of that decade and the emerging populist movement that a fellow, an aspiring politician from New York by the name of Teddy Roosevelt said, we need to get this country involved in a war, and it doesn't really matter where. And that was the same conclusion that the U.S. Consul General to Havana, Cuba, a fellow by the name of Fitzhugh Lee, had reached in 1896. He said that a foreign war was just a thing to knock the pus out of the populistic boil. Now, think for just a second about what that characterization says about this guy's perspective of the common population of the United States. Of course, you know, pus is something that is generated by an infection. He was basically saying that those of his fellow countrymen who were angered by what the oligarchy ruling them at that time were doing and who were trying to find some means of asserting their political rights and protection of their own aspirations, defense of their own property and livelihood, that they were the equivalent of an infection of the body politic. So what do you do when you've got an infection in the body politic? Well, you need to amputate sometimes if it becomes gangrenous, or you need to have a bloodletting as a way of dealing. This, of course, is primitive medicine, but in primitive medicine, you'd have a bloodletting as a way of dealing with that type of an infection. And, of course, a bloodletting is best arranged through a war. So you ended up with a pleasant little engagement called the Spanish-American War, which is one that was completely without justification. It was staged on the basis of false premises. The Maine was not bombed by Spain. It was the victim of an accident. But with the help of Mr. Hearst and some of the other practitioners of yellow journalism, the population was riled up to a fine frenzy of war fever against Spain. There was a constant barrage of propaganda stories about the horrible things the Spaniards were doing to the poor Cubans and the poor Filipinos, and so the United States invaded and ousted the Spaniards from Cuba and from the Philippines and from Puerto Rico and from a number of other holdings, and we ended up, for the first time in our experience, with an overseas empire. And of course, in the Philippines, it took the better part of a decade to burn out the ambition to pacify that country through mass bloodletting, but by the time they were finished in the Philippines, there were probably 2 or 3 million Filipinos who were dead as a result of this particularly aggressive expression of America's humanitarian impulse through military invasion and occupation. But the primary purpose of all this, as Fitzhugh Lee and Teddy Roosevelt pointed out, was that they needed to have a war in order to put down the rising populist sentiment against the oligarchy. That was the overriding purpose. Of course, a secondary and very important consideration was that there were new territories to play with here in terms of concessions and lucrative corporate ventures backed by the so-called full faith and credit of the United States. Once the Philippines were in the possession of the oligarchy, of course, they wanted to use that as a staging area to pry open China. And I just finished reading a remarkable and perfectly infuriating book by a fellow named Bradley. He's the author of, among other things, Flags of Our Fathers and Flyboys. Flags of Our Fathers and Flyboys are two books that have been made into movies. This book is called The Imperial Cruise. It's written by James Bradley. And he talks about the way that Roosevelt, the people behind Roosevelt, abetted the rise of the Imperial Japanese military and the military oligarchy of that country in the early years of the 20th century because they wanted to use Japan as a way of use them basically as a subcontractor for the American Empire. They were talking about Japan presiding over an area in northern Asia in the name of what they called an Asian Monroe Doctrine. They would be in charge of Korea. Essentially, Teddy Roosevelt turned over Korea to the tender mercies of Japan, talked to a Korean sometime about how they felt about Japanese occupation and rule. He'll probably rifle very quickly through his available inventory of expletives because it was a horrible thing that was done to Korea. That was the handiwork of Teddy Roosevelt's secret diplomacy. And Teddy Roosevelt secretly was conniving with Japan to goad them into war with Russia, and he ended up negotiating an end to the Russian War, winning a Nobel Peace Prize for bringing to a negotiated end a war of aggression by Japan that he had secretly abetted. And this is all part of this long-term project for the empire in that part of the world, and this had the salutary effect from their point of view of putting the oligarchy in a position where they could continue to use a war as a means of running off these foul humors and infections of a populace.
Well, I think, William, one thing that we should realize is that this was, many people felt this was America's manifest destiny. America was going to lead the world into this new world order. There's very little understanding that it really began with the Spanish-American War and then the Filipino-American War, which they never even study in our or talk about in our history books, this terrible genocide of the Filipino people by the American military, which, go up on Wikipedia and read about the Filipino-American War and say, how could you have a war with a couple of million people killed and we'd never even heard about it? But really, of course, Teddy Roosevelt was part of this move, this globalist movement, and this was the beginning of America's manifest destiny, which is actually being carried out today as America leads the world towards the New World Order and the New World Religion. Go ahead.
Exactly, and it's an important thing to point out here that the people who are promoting this were joined at the hip with religious leaders in the so-called Christian Church, who were part of the Rockefeller-funded Federal Council of Churches. They were really sort of transmuting Christianity into a fighting, secularized faith. These were people who actually studied the gospel according to Hegel and the gospel according to Darwin, and they used, in the fashion of contemporary liberty or liberation theology, they used and they transposed the terms of Christianity, transvaluating them by incorporating Darwinian and Hegelian notions into the language of sermons and other exhortations in support of this imperial foreign policy that had nothing to do with our origins as a republic. It had nothing to do with preserving constitutional rule or promoting the defense of American property and the rights of American citizens, or even providing a good example to the world of what a commercial republic is like. These were people who were very much part and parcel. They were of a kidney with the people who are running our oligarchical regime today. It's the same mindset that led us to the misadventure in Iraq and the misadventure in Afghanistan. It's the same thing that's going to lead to tragedy with respect to the impending war with Iran. And once again, they look upon us basically as disposable. They had no scruple at all about seeing 2 or 3 million Filipinos be slaughtered. And those who weren't slaughtered outright were often tortured through the use of what we now call waterboarding. There was one private in the Filipino War who heard that Roosevelt had been elected in 1900, and what he said was, well, apparently that means that we're supposed to kill all the Filipino men, we're supposed to rape all the Filipino women and raise up a new race here on the island. And he didn't think that this was a bad idea. The thing is, nobody who has so much as a scintilla of genuine Christian conviction could be party to that type of a crime. Nobody who understands anything about the gospel, nobody who understands anything about the Constitution, could be party to that type of a crime. But even as long ago as late 1890s, the same self-perpetuating power elite we're dealing with today had entrenched itself so deeply in all these instruments of culture and society, including the church leadership, that people were carefully misguided into embracing this campaign and doing all these horrible things that result in the deaths of thousands of Americans and literally millions of Filipinos, and then set the dials for the War in the Pacific that came decades later. And we're still living with the consequences of all of that today.
Amen to that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have to understand it's like deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
We placed the mullahs in power in Iran back in 1979 when the CIA toppled the Shah and actually helped the Ayatollah Khomeini to come to power. We trained the ruthless secret police of the Shah. They became, of course, other people who defended the Ayatollahs. The Ayatollahs were involved in episode of terrorism after episode, bombing the American embassy in Beirut and killing the Marines in Beirut. And we covered for them at every turn. Why? Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
All right. Thanks again, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you on Friday nights. interestingly enough.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-Dry Guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show, 13 August 2010. It is Friday. Thank you so much for joining us today, being here, caring about your bodies, your temple, caring about your family, your world, your neighbors, your foxhole buddies. That's right. We need to be having our foxhole buddies right alongside with us because I'm telling you, we're going to need some people there by our side. It's going to come to a time when there's only going to
teamwork,
be a very...
a passion for justice.
Very
over 30 years fighting...